Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be bringing you a reflection marking the World Day of the Sick. Joining an historian for a comment on the anniversary of the Lateran Pacts. I'll also be looking ahead to Ash Wednesday with a musical meditation. But first, here in the Vatican, discussion has been centering around emerging youth cultures this week as the annual plenary assembly of the Pontifical Council for Culture is taking place. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. The 6th to the 9th of February, these are the dates for the annual plenary assembly of the Pontifical Council for Culture, whose president, as we know, is Cardinal Gianfranco Ravasi. The offices of the Pontifical Council for Culture are just opposite ours here at the radio, so Eamon McCarthy popped round to speak to Richard Rouse, an official at the council, to find out more about this year's special focus on emerging youth cultures. Richard Rouse began by explaining what the idea is behind the choice of this year's theme, telling Eamon that it's an effort to examine youth cultures, to make a critical examination of the strange things that we might be seeing, to try and understand them, and also be near to youth. So, all in all, critical analysis and cultural nearness. But why don't we listen to this interview to find out more?
Emerging youth cultures is a plural. It's quite a vast subject or topic. Can you perhaps narrow it down just a little bit for our listeners and give us an example of what we're actually speaking about when we use the term youth cultures?
That's the whole point, actually. It is plurality. It's not just one culture. It's not a grey mass, this youth reality. There are lots and lots of subcultures, lots of very hopeful realities. We have as a subtitle Faith in the Youth. So it's a play on words. The faith, you know, where in this year of the faith, where is the faith in the youth? But also it's our trust in them. We're looking to the youth positively.
Now, can you take us through some of the people invited to speak on this topic and perhaps pick out some highlights of the events and discussions?
The opening evening is a highlight in itself, in as much as we have a rock group. So we'll have our cardinals and our bishops and our consultors, these very highbrow intellectual men and women of culture, engaging with the youth through the language of music, through the language of rock music. Cardinal Ravasi has been trying to engage with the music of Amy Winehouse in the last few days, and he's very interested in finding out what are the expectations of the youth, what is their language, what is this desire, this very strong, passionate, emotional will to participate in life, to participate in drama of life, but at the same time it's not engaging with the church. Why is there this breakdown in the transmission of the faith? Why are we not able to talk to them in a language that they can understand? We have talks on digital natives, on their languages and rituals. This is going to be Antonio Spadaro. He's a young person at heart. We have a young blogger from America talking about the emotive alphabet, literacy, this language that young people speak, how they engage with their emotions in many good ways. We have a round table where we'll have an Indonesian, a Canadian, and an African talking about participation, creativity, generosity, volunteering, the way that new communities are growing, responding to the needs, the desires, the potential that young people have and can give to society today.
You're, in a way of saying, I know you're a father of three, but you're quite a young face of the Pontifical Council for Culture. What are your hopes coming out of this General Assembly?
A greater acceptance of the gifts that young people have and a more natural way of ensuring that these gifts are employed and fostered and tutored for the good of the church and for the good of society. There's a generation gap. Sometimes we talk about a digital divide between generations. Sometimes, as you say, I'm a father myself, you live it in the family. A digital divide within the home, where the parents and the children are watching different television channels or surfing the internet on different machines in different rooms within the same house. The church has this wonderful vision of community. How are we ensuring that everybody can bring their gifts to bear to the community?
And our thanks there go to Richard Rouse, an official at the Pontifical Council for Culture. And also to Emma McCarthy for speaking to him. At this point, I thought I'd look ahead to Monday, 11th of February, as we have two special anniversaries to remember on that date. The first, as you know, is Our Lady of Lourdes, a day we remember the sick in a special way. So let's begin then by marking that date with Monsignor Peter Fleetwood's very personal reflection.
I rang my parents in Wales one evening to ask them if they would like to visit Our Lady's shrine in Lourdes. They were delighted and accepted straight away. The months passed by as normal, but just 10 days before we were due to go, the doctors in the hospital in Chester told my mother she had an inoperable tumour on her lung and would need treatment. Having grown up poor, one of the first things she worried about was whether I would lose any money if she was unable to go to Lourdes. Luckily, she was reassured when I said it didn't matter, but that anyway, she was to make up her own mind and not be bullied by anyone into going or not going. Having grown up a strong Catholic, she decided Lourdes was the best place to be, so we went. Mum had a difficult trip, and some people criticised me for making her suffer the inconvenience and even pain of going to the airport and the indignity of being pushed around Lourdes in a wheelchair. Why bother putting her through all that inconvenience? Poor Dad was at his wit's end and very depressed about why all this was happening. Why bother if the life you have built together has to end like this? And they both hated the attention which naturally comes your way if you're in a wheelchair in Lourdes or pushing one. We are very private people. The change came the day before we went home. Mum was scared of going to the baths at the shrine. The woman from the Isle of Man who took her in told me later on in tears of laughter that Mum was afraid because she couldn't swim. Nobody had told her it was a small bath into which the helpers lower you carefully. She must have thought it was an Olympic-sized swimming pool. I stayed outside with Dad, who was unusually nervous and short-tempered. It was very difficult for him. Why was all this happening? He got an answer when Mum came out with a radiant face, saying, "I've done everything I wanted to do now. Will you take me for a coffee, Peter?" She was amazed by the kindness absolutely everyone showed her. And Dad said that the wait outside the baths and walking around Lourdes had made him realise he had been feeling far too sorry for himself. His eyes had been opened by other people's sufferings. Two little miracles. Mum died less than 3 weeks later. My dad's burden was made much lighter, and the people who had been so critical said how wonderful it was that Mum had had the chance to go to Lourdes. What about me? Well, the big miracle was that this couple who hardly ever went anywhere accepted the invitation so quickly. Most people think of priests and other professional Catholics as people of faith, but I can tell you that on this occasion I was the one who was doing most of the learning. In a way, without wanting to give the wrong impression, I can honestly say that the miracles of the 1850s became distant memories when one sees the recurring miracles at Lourdes today. When I invited Mum and Dad to come, I had to be chaplain to a group which brought with it plenty of work but lots of fun, and very moving moments with people I felt really pleased and privileged to meet. Many times in the course of my work, I'm tempted to say, why bother staying here? But my own frustrations paled into insignificance on that special pilgrimage. That has often happened to me on trips to Lourdes, and on visits to hospital or prison, or even to sick people in their homes. The people who wondered whether it was worth bothering to take Mum on a difficult journey to a shrine in a foreign country got their answer, and were gracious enough to admit it. There were also many people like me who went as Christians who often wonder why they should bother remaining in the church or believing in God or being good people. I think many of us got our answer too. I would recommend it.
And warm thanks there to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood for sharing with us these thoughts relating to Lourdes. Now, the second of the anniversaries on Monday, 11th of February, is connected to our radio station, because it was this date, with the consequent birth of Vatican City State, that the stage was set for Vatican Radio. In a few moments, I'll be joining our historian, Professor Gerald Fogarty of the University of Virginia in the United States, as he shines the spotlight on this special date. Turning to February 11th, 1929, we talk about the Roman Question and the Lateran Pacts, but there are different parts to that. Lateran Treaty, a Concordat, and a Third Pact, aren't there?
Yeah, it gets complicated. They overlap. A Concordat, for our English-speaking listeners, is important. There's never been a Concordat in an English-speaking country because of the British and American common law. You have the rights that are not restricted by going to court. Whereas in the Roman law tradition, which runs throughout Europe for the most part, you have the rights the state gives you. So therefore, a concordat was an agreement between the Holy See and the government to guarantee the rights of the church within a particular country. And almost every European nation does have a concordat. So therefore, that was one of the things that came in. The treaty was to end the Roman Question. There would be an indemnification for what was lost and so forth, the land lost. And the Pope had never touched what had been set aside in the Law of Guarantees in 1872. So now there was a general indemnification. And then included in that was the freedom of communication with his bishops everywhere, and also the right to the diplomatic corps and the right of cardinals, who at that time were given the rank of Prince of the Blood, by the way. They were considered to be royalty and to be treated as such. But thank God we've done
blue
away.
Blood.
Yeah.
So anyway, this definitively put an end to the Roman Question.
Yes, and what it meant was by 1861, all of Italy was now united except for the city of Rome. The city of Rome still remained in the temporal control of the Pope only because French troops had come to defend the Pope here. So therefore, that's why the end of the control over Rome, that's why it becomes the Roman Question. Because after all, the Pope is the Bishop of Rome, and yet he never visited his own cathedral from 1870, St.
John Lateran.
That's right. People, St. Peter's is not a cathedral. It is a major basilica, but the chair is not there. The chair, that is the cathedra, is actually St. John Lateran. And that's where the Pope had...
That's why he's called Bishop of Rome, the Pope.
That's right. And one of his many titles. So that was the significance that now the Roman Question was settled with the Holy See recognizing that the Kingdom of Italy in 1929 now had control of the city of Rome, legally. And it brought about a regularization between the two entities.
So it was a rigid and rainy day, and a Mussolini for the Italian state, and Cardinal Gaspari for the Holy See, then it was.
Holy See. And then right after that, Gaspari resigned, and the new Secretary of State was Eugenio Pacelli, who later on became Pius XII. And we could talk about this at some other time, perhaps, but that also brought about a change in the attitude of the Holy See towards the United States. The Holy See regarded the United States in 1899 with great suspicion. Gradually, that starts to change because it was obvious that another war was going to come. And with that other war, the Holy See knew they would have to do something with the United States.
And Pius XII was the first to visit the United States, but not as Pope.
That's right. In 1936, the first Pope to come as Pope was Paul VI. But Pacelli came over in 1936, supposedly as the house guest of Mrs. Brady, who endowed a number of things around here. And the trip was taken over by this auxiliary bishop who was a close friend of Pacelli's who had worked in the Secretary of State. His name was Francis Spellman. He was auxiliary bishop of Boston. And he and Mrs. Brady had a major falling out because Bishop Spellman knew that Pacelli wanted to meet the president, Roosevelt. So how do you arrange this? And finally, it was done in 1936 through this subterfuge. You had the official hierarchical group working on it through the United States State Department, when all of a sudden Pacelli called the apostolic delegate, the papal representative to the hierarchy. He said, don't worry, we have made arrangements through Monsignor Spellman. It was done through Joe Kennedy, the father of President John Kennedy. And the idea was that they would meet at the president's mother's house for lunch 2 days after his election to a second term. So it was not an official state visit. Because how did you arrange for the prime minister and foreign minister of an entity with which the United States does not have diplomatic relations to meet with the head of state? So that was the problem.
Going back to the Lateran Pacts, of course, beyond that historic signing in 1929, there was a lot of behind-the-scenes work that went on towards that moment, long before that date, no?
Oh, yeah. In fact, the work for that began at the Treaty of Versailles in 1919. And there was this interesting priest,
American.
Yeah, Francis Kelly. And he became the Bishop of Oklahoma City later on. But he had in his diary or something how he talked to the foreign minister. And a lot of people thought this was phony until the actual signing of the pact where the foreign minister of Italy said the first step was taken by this American priest who could sort of be incognito to a great extent. Incidentally, the Lateran treaties did not end hostility between the Holy See and the government. By that time, the fascist government was in control of the government under the king, under the House of Savoy. But by 1931, there was great tension. The Concordat had been violated. So then there was an encyclical condemning fascism.
Pius XI's 1939 encyclical, Non Abbiamo Bisogno, on Catholic Action.
They couldn't publish it in the city because the fascists had shut down the Catholic presses, so it had to be smuggled out of Italy. And they gave it to this then Monsignor Spellman, who was working in the Secretariat of State, because as an American citizen, they weren't going to stop him. And he took it by train to Paris, where it was published by the Associated Press and United Press International, the first encyclical I know of that was not published under official church auspices, but under, you know, the regular journalistic outlets.
And did it get a lot of publicity?
It did. Because it was clear then that the Pope was not at all sympathetic with fascism. He was willing to cooperate with him. 2 years later, he signed the Concordat with the Third Reich, with Hitler. And at that time, he made the comment he would sign a Concordat with the devil if it meant he could preserve the rights of the Church. There's a book done by a German scholar recently they called The Pope and the Devil, because picking up on that phrase. But the purpose of any Concordat is to preserve the rights of the Church and give it standing, give any dispute standing within international law.
And wasn't he criticized for that?
Oh, yeah, well, especially his Secretary of State. But after all, still, it was the Pope who is the one who authorized the negotiation and the signing of the Concordat. But he was criticized because was this recognition of Hitler. Well, it had been under work from 1929, actually, because before Pacelli became Secretary of State, 1914, he was appointed as the nuncio to the Kingdom of Bavaria. And then with the new empire, with the Weimar Republic after 1919, then he became the nuncio also to the Weimar Republic. He was there for another 10 years, 1929, when he came back here to Rome. I say back here to Rome because he was Roman-born.
Pius XI found it hard to actually adapt to the new situation after the signing of the Lateran Pacts. He couldn't be persuaded to move out of the Vatican, but there were some exceptions, like the time he did go to Castelvandolo, 1938.
Yes.
And there was a reason connected
very definitely a reason. Because Hitler was making a state visit to the city of Rome, and there was all this preparation, the Via Foro Imperiale. They just probably shoveled over all sorts of ruins to make this wide avenue. Everyone has seen it somewhere near the Colosseum into the
Piazza Venezia.
Yeah, and it's probably under it were a lot of ruins.
Probably destroyed a lot of beautiful things.
Yeah.
Buildings and architectural.
What the Pope did is normally he doesn't go out to Castel Gandolfo until July, although maybe they start going out earlier now because.
Depends on the popes. The popes have different patterns.
Time he went out in May so that he would not be present. And they also closed the Vatican museums. And then there was debate as to whether or not Hitler would ask for an audience. He didn't. And what would the Pope respond if he did? Then there was a marvelous naval parade because they had to do that in Naples. So they took the train down with Hitler. And the United States naval attaché went down, and they had 90 Italian submarines that all came out in one mass flotilla, and they dove on one end of the harbor, and several minutes later they all rose at the same time at the other end. And even our United States naval attaché was fascinated by this. For the display in the Piazza Venezia here, most of the ambassadors were not invited, and the United States was not invited, for instance. So the United States ambassador to the kingdom took a seat that he could get. He was getting to be elderly. And nevertheless, he described what happened because Mussolini was fascinated by the Nazi soldiers and their goose step. So he put in what they called the Passo Romano. It was goose stepping Italian troops. Didn't quite work. And a lot of comments in the newspapers because what they were used to was the Passo Italiano, which was much more freewheeling. The Italians cheered when that happened, when they saw it. And by the way, the Pope also had an audience for several hundred newly married couples at Castel Gandolfo, and he talked about what a crime it was that you had the cross of Christ overshadowed by the crooked cross, the swastika, and that this was a disgrace to the Italian nation as a Christian nation.
Finally, as Ash Wednesday approaches, the exact date, as you know, is the 13th of February this year, I'd like to end the broadcast with a musical meditation focusing on this day, which announces the season of Lent. For this, we join our music historian, Monsignor Philip Whittemore.
Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And he fasted 40 days and 40 nights, and afterwards he was hungry.
40 days and 40 nights the was fasting in the barn. 40 days and 40 nights tempted the devil divine.
In the season of Lent, we join Lord Jesus in his fast of 40 days. We devote ourselves to prayer, to fasting, and to almsgiving so as to prepare ourselves spiritually for the great events of Holy Week and Easter. Although Lent is a joyful season, it is austere, and this austerity is reflected in our liturgy. We use purple vestments, we omit the Gloria and the Alleluia, and our hymns take on a more solemn tone. The one we've been listening to is based on a German chorale tune, first published in 1676 in Nuremberg. The tune is called Aus der Tiefe, meaning out of the depths, so it was probably sung to the psalm that we know as the De Profundis. Like many German chorales, it was used in an organ prelude by J.S. Bach, or possibly one of his sons. The organ version is rather slower than we would normally sing it, but I think you'll recognise the tune all the same.
Thank you.
40 Days and 40 Nights was written in the 19th century, but some of our Lenten hymns are much older. Lord Jesus, Think on Me is a 19th century translation of a 5th century Greek hymn, originally written by Synesius of Cyrene. Tune isn't quite that old, but it was widely sung in the 16th and 17th centuries when it was associated with a metrical psalm. I lift my heart to thee, my God and guide most just. Now suffer me to take no shame, for I in thee do trust. It was wise of 19th century editors to choose metrical psalm tunes as Lenten hymn tunes. Their simple austerity is well suited to the sombre tone of the Lenten liturgy. From our Catholic tradition, the hymn God of Mercy and Compassion tells of God's mercy to us sinners. The words were written by the 19th century Redemptorist priest Edmund Vaughan, uncle of the future Cardinal Herbert Vaughan, who founded Westminster Cathedral. The tune is based on a traditional French melody that was arranged by the 18th century Italian composer Giovanni Pergolesi. Like many Victorian Catholic hymns, it uses a refrain in which we express our firm purpose of amendment. All my sins, I now detest them. Never will I sin again. Throughout the 40 days of Lent, we never lose sight of the goal that lies ahead of us. By our fasting and our penance, we prepare to celebrate the great feast of Easter with minds and hearts renewed. Keep, O keep us, Saviour dear, ever constant by thy side, that with thee we may appear at the eternal Eastertide.
Big thank you there to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian, who is currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.